And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Rusty Deweese always brings a smile to my face when he's doing his commercials. We're going to get right into presidential politics today and yesterday's Super Tuesday results with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, and then Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. And then we're going to take a breather from presidential politics and switch to Vermont's new universal recycling law. What does the law mean to you, to residents, to businesses, to schools and municipalities and haulers? We'll talk with Josh Kelly, who is the Materials Management Section Chief at the Department of Environmental Conservation. But first up, Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mike.
Eric, let's talk the Democrats first. What's your take on what happened last night?
Well, my take on last night is that although Bernie Sanders did win Vermont big, and he won caucus states in Minnesota and in Colorado and one in Oklahoma, Hillary Clinton ended up doing very, very well in the southern states, and she expanded her lead in delegates. So I would say that the next 2 weeks are really critical for the Bernie Sanders campaign. We have several big states coming up on March 15th, Ohio and Illinois and Florida and Missouri and North Carolina, with Michigan before that on the 8th of March. And if Sanders is to remain a viable candidate beyond mid-March, I think he needs to win at least one and preferably several of those big states. He can continue until California and New Jersey in June because he's continuing to get the money from his small contributions. But unless he starts to close the gap with Clinton by winning some of the big states in mid-March, her progress toward the nomination is going to accelerate.
You know, it's interesting, Eric. I looked into past the numbers into the, sort of the breakdowns, especially in the southern states. Sanders does fine with the white vote, but when he gets to the minority vote, blacks, Hispanics, she wins huge, as Bernie would say.
That's right. And in states like Alabama and Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina last week, Hillary Clinton is running up huge percentages among African-American voters, 75% or more in many of these states. From the exit polls that I've looked at and polls from the other states held earlier this year, Bernie Sanders has two core constituencies, really. He has middle-class progressives in Midwestern and Northeastern states. We saw that in New Hampshire. We saw it in Vermont. We saw it in Minnesota. And he has young voters. If you look at Massachusetts, that Hillary Clinton won narrowly, Bernie Sanders did very, very well in communities with large numbers of young voters and with more progressive and professional voters. But the bulk of the voters in Massachusetts, in the populous Boston suburbs, voted for Hillary Clinton.
What's interesting is you can't win the nomination without getting some portion of that minority vote, can you?
That's right. That's right. And again, the African-American vote is going to be important in some of these big states because you're now getting into cities. You're talking about Cleveland and Chicago and places like that where there is a large African-American community, and Hillary Clinton clearly has strong support there. Sanders also needs to demonstrate support with some of the manufacturing unions that are very important in states like Michigan and Ohio, the auto workers in particular.
Other than Vermont, Eric, the other states came in late. The Minnesota, Colorado, Oklahoma came in around 10 o'clock. But the narrative was already set because of those very decisive victories in the South by Hillary Clinton. Do you think if those states would have come in sooner that the narrative would have been different? The narrative we're hearing today is Clinton won big.
Yeah, and I think that's accurate. I think that's accurate. I mean, the delegates are awarded proportionally, so even if Sanders loses in a state, he does get some delegates. But if he gets defeated by a margin of 2 or 3 to 1, which happened in many of these southern states, he's only going to get a third or a third of the delegates, or perhaps even a little bit less. I also found interesting Hillary Clinton's speech last night, where she's already in Florida. And she seemed to be focusing as much on Donald Trump in the general election campaign as she was on Bernie Sanders.
All Donald Trump has to do is read the New York Times to figure out what her plan is, because it seems to be right in there yesterday, and she seemed to be following the script last night.
Exactly. And I think Donald Trump's nomination is less of a certainty than Hillary Clinton's at this point, because it's hard to come up with a scenario in which anyone other than Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, unless Sanders really turns things around in the next couple of weeks. But it's still possible, not necessarily going to happen, but it's possible to envision the so-called broken convention scenario where Cruz, Kasich, and Rubio all managed to get enough delegates to deny Trump a majority coming into the convention in Cleveland in the summer.
Rubio is reportedly, according to newspaper reports, planning for a brokered convention. Is that a good strategy, or just divides the Republicans?
Realistically, I think that may be where Rubio is at this point. I think for Rubio, he needs to win his home state of Florida on March 15th, and Kasich needs to win his home state of Ohio on March 15th.
And both are trailing Trump at the moment.
And both are trailing Trump, but they could turn that around. They could turn that around because they've both won elections recently in those states. Kasich more recently, who was elected two years ago, than Rubio, who was elected 6 years ago. I'll be interested to see whether Jeb Bush, if he has any pulling power left in Florida, whether Jeb Bush endorses Rubio or stays quiet over the next 2 weeks, and how much money Kasich is able to raise for his Ohio campaign in the next 2 weeks.
So just recapping, the Democrats, Hillary Clinton won 7 states, Bernie Sanders won Vermont, of course, big time in Vermont, Minnesota, Colorado, and Oklahoma. Turning to the Republicans, Donald Trump won 7 states, a lot of clear victories in those states. Ted Cruz had clear victories in Oklahoma and Texas and Alaska, and Rubio had a win in Minnesota. What's your take on the Republicans? What's going to happen here?
Well, I think, again, we're getting into these big states, and Trump is going to, sort of his economic nationalism appeal, he hopes will appeal to manufacturing workers in states like Ohio and Michigan. He hopes that his anti-immigration appeal will have some resonance in Florida. He tries to project himself as a winner, although I think in the general election he clearly has some problems. One of the things I found interesting is, though he won a large number of states yesterday, he didn't get above 50% in any of them. And if Trump can't get more than 50% within the Republican Party, I think that's a warning sign for the general election. So, as I said, I think that there's still more uncertainty on the Trump's the leader, but there's more uncertainty on the Republican side than on the Democratic side.
Of course, Trump is touting the fact that he is expanding the turnout of the Republican Party, bringing in independents, bringing in conservative Democrats even into the party. Do you think he's got a point there?
I think he may have a point. And one of the interesting things about the Vermont results yesterday is the overall turnout was about 190,000, which was roughly the same as the overall turnout in the primary 8 years ago when we had competitive campaigns on both the Democratic and the Republican side. But the Democratic turnout was down by about 20,000 from 2 years ago, even with Bernie on the ballot. And the Republican turnout was up about 20,000. Now, I think that I can give two reasons for that. First is, I think Trump did bring some people to the polls, even in Vermont, who previously hadn't voted in presidential primaries. I think he does have an ability to bring previous non-voters out. But the other reason I think the Vermont turnout switched is, I think a fair number of independents in Vermont who might have voted in the Democratic primary 8 years ago voted in the Republican primary this year, and they voted either for Rubio or Kasich rather than for Trump.
Eric, I was looking at those figures and I was curious because it's 2-1. I was figuring it's going to be 3-1 in terms of turnout, Democrat versus Republican, but 2-1 sort of surprised me.
It surprised me. And when I looked at the town by town results, the several news organization sites have those posted. What I noticed is that Trump did best in smaller communities in northern Vermont, Franklin County, the Northeast Kingdom, and in Rutland County. And those are the core Republican areas in state elections. Kasich and Rubio did better in Chittenden County, Windsor County, and Washington County. And those are places that statewide Republicans need to win in order to win the governorship and other statewide offices. So I did find that interesting that what I think was going on is that in the Chittenden County suburbs and some of the larger communities in Washington and Windsor counties, independents chose the Republican ballot and voted either for Rubio or for Kasich.
Where does Bernie go from here?
Where does Bernie go from here? I think he needs to find a state that he can win. Michigan, I think he's obviously going to try and appeal to auto workers with his message about economic inequality. We'll see how he does there. And then you have those big states on the 15th, five of them: Ohio, Illinois, North Carolina, Florida, and Missouri. And unless he can win at least one, and preferably a couple of them, Hillary Clinton's just going to continue to pad her lead in terms of delegates. So I think the road ahead gets more difficult for Bernie with each passing week.
And as you look at Florida on the Republican side, you look at Florida, you look at Ohio, you look at those other states that are coming up. Let's take the home state of Rubio, which is Florida. Trump is up big, according to polls there.
Trump is up big. Now, Rubio is gonna make his last stand in Florida, and he hopes to raise a lot of money. I'm not sure how the big donors are going. I did find interesting on CNBC this morning, there were two very big Republican donors, Stanley Druckenmiller and Ken Langone, business people, and they were on pitching Kasich. And I'll be interested to see how the sort of the big money, the super PAC money, much of which had been behind Jeb Bush, where that money starts to flow in the next 2 weeks. Will it go to Rubio? Will it go to Kasich?
And in Ohio, great segue, in Ohio, Trump is ahead of Kasich, which is astonishing to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Kasich has a possibility of winning in Ohio. I mean, he's a popular governor there. I think he can argue that, he, as presidential candidate, would be obviously competitive in Ohio in the fall. No Republican has ever won the presidency without winning Ohio in the last century. So I think he can make an argument there against Trump. And, again, there are two more Republican debates. I know there's one Thursday night this week, and I believe there's another one next week. So there are two debates between now and March 15th. And both the moderators and Rubio, Trump, and Cruz are gonna push Trump. Cruz will argue that Cruz is the only true conservative left in the race. I think Rubio has to figure out whether his strategy is ridicule or substance in the next debate. And Kasich is just going to continue presenting this image of a competent manager.
Don't they have to get down to just two, or else it's going to be to Trump's advantage along the way?
Yeah, unless the other three can manage to win enough delegates to collectively come into the convention with a majority among them, and then we bargain. I was doing some historical research last night, and the last presidential convention that went to a second ballot was actually the Democratic convention in 1952. The last Republican convention that went to a second ballot was back in 1948. So it's something we've not seen for 70 years or so. But I think there is a possibility we could see the brokered convention scenario in the Republican Party this year. The other interesting thing in the Republicans is on some talk shows and some op-ed pages, there's some conservative columnists and sort of foreign policy types in Washington who just can't stand Trump, who say he's temperamentally unsuited to be president, knows nothing about foreign policy, his ideas are wrong. And they're starting to float the idea of some sort of a third-party candidacy. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that, and if there were a third-party sort of constitutionalist conservative candidate, what impact such a candidate would have on the electoral vote, that remains to be seen. But that's another possibility out there.
Or what impact it would have on the Republican Party. It would sort of split the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Would there be
a
Republican Party as we know it now?
That's an excellent question. I saw an interview last night with Heather Cox Richardson, who's a historian at Boston College. She's written a book about the history of the Republican Party from Lincoln up to the present. And she said there is a real possibility of a schism in the Republican Party, that you have sort of the Trump nationalist populist wing, and then you have the more sort of neoconservative Reagan slash Bush wing. And those two groups really are incompatible. I mean, Trump does not accept the basic premises of Republican ideology of the last 20 years: smaller government, lower taxes, free market economy, and a vigorous American involvement in international affairs, including military intervention when appropriate. And Trump just doesn't accept those principles.
We're speaking with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We're talking about the Republican Party, the conservatives who are really worried that Trump isn't a conservative. Do you think they just waited too late to take Trump on?
I don't think they thought he would last this long. I think that's what I found surprising, listening to some of them yesterday and reading some of what they've written. And in a way, the rules the Republicans set up after the last election haven't made the situation any better for the sort of, let's call them, constitutional conservatives, neoconservatives, whatever you want to call them. Because beginning on March 15th, states can use winner-take-all to select their delegates. So if Trump wins a state with roughly the same percentage as he did yesterday, somewhere in the 40-45% range, he can get 100% of the delegates from that state if the anti-Trump vote is divided three ways among Kasich, Rubio, and Cruz. And what the Republican National Committee thought when it made those rules, it would help a mainstream candidate like Mitt Romney wrap up the nomination early and start focusing on Hillary Clinton. The rules now are going to advantage Donald Trump.
Yesterday we asked the question, should Bernie continue on if he has a bad Super Tuesday and then, of course, the next sort of rounds that you had mentioned? He's got to win one of these bigger states. And almost to a T, the callers called in, Eric, and said, stay in because we don't know what's going to happen with Hillary Clinton. You just never know what happens with the Clintons. Scandal, controversy always surrounds the Clintons. And, of course, people are holding out some hope, whether it's Republican or Bernie Sanders, that this email controversy is something that's going to cause her a problem.
Well, let me make two comments on that. First of all, I think in some ways Bernie owes it to his supporters in states like New York, Pennsylvania, California. They aren't going to be voting until April or May or even early June in California's case to stay in the race, because these are people who've been loyal supporters to him. They've been sending him the $25, $50, $100 contributions. He has enough money to keep going. He's not attacking Hillary Clinton so much as he's raising his issues. So he can keep running as a message candidate right through June and make a speech at the convention and so forth. My view on the email matter is if it does escalate, so to speak, and starts creating serious problems for Hillary Clinton, what the Democratic Party in that situation would do is likely turn to Vice President Biden as their presidential nominee if something were to make Hillary Clinton unacceptable as the nominee.
We're speaking with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Bernie and Trump have hit on a theme that seems to say the same thing, that the system is rigged. They come at it different ways. Bernie talks about it's rigged by billionaires, the economic, you know, rigging the economic and the political system. Trump comes at it from D.C. elites and business elites, really, you know, trying to hold on to power to the system. He comes in as the outsider, trying to wrestle away that power. They both describe their campaigns as movement. Isn't that curious?
Yeah, and there are some similarities, but there are also differences. I mean, Bernie Sanders has been in Congress for 25 years, and whether you agree with him or not, he does have well-developed positions on policy issues. Donald Trump does not. The other thing is, part of Trump's campaign is sort of saying that America is weak because of the others, whether the others are immigrants, other countries who are beating us in trade, as he puts it, foreign businesses. And there's a nationalist component to Trump's rhetoric that one doesn't find in Bernie Sanders' rhetoric. And the social bases of the two candidates are quite different, actually. If you look at people who are voting for Sanders, the middle-class progressives who vote for Sanders often tend to be people with not just a college degree, but an advanced degree to work in a professional occupation of some type or another. Whereas the people who are voting for Trump tend to be more than the population as a whole, people who never attended college. So there's some differences there.
One of the things that I always do is after these elections, I go back and look at what the polls said here in Vermont. And, of course, about a week ago, we had a VPR poll that mm-hmm. was released, showed that Sanders had support among about 83% of voters. Actually, it was 86, so that was pretty close. But when you looked at the Republican side, there was this expectation that Trump was going to blow everyone out. He had roughly 32%. Marco Rubio was second place at 16%. And yet it turned out to be a pretty close race with Trump winning at 32%, winning in Vermont. I never thought I'd say that. Trump winning in Vermont at 32%, and John Kasich coming in at 28%. What'd you read in looking at the polls after the results?
Well, I mean, first of all, that poll was conducted in late 2 to 3 weeks before the election, and there's been a lot of news developments, especially on the Republican side since then. There were candidates in that poll who are no longer candidates, for example. Also, in those last 2 weeks, what you had is you had John Kasich come to Vermont twice in campaign, so he got some good news coverage out of that. He did have a bit of a field organization in Vermont. In at least some towns, Kasich signs appeared a day or two before the election. And Rubio was endorsed by a number of the state's leading Republicans, Lieutenant Governor Scott, and more than half of the Republicans in the legislature held a press conference to endorse Rubio last week. So I think Kasich, with his campaigning in the state, his appeal to independents, Rubio with the Republican elected officials in Vermont moving into his camp, they were able to close the gap that Trump had on them in that poll that was taken several weeks earlier.
Those politicians, those Democratic politicians that supported Hillary Clinton, she got around 9% of the vote here in Vermont. Do you think today they're waking up and saying, these active politicians that have got to go before the voters and be reelected themselves or elected, do you think they wake up this morning and go, is this a problem for me?
Well, the people we're talking about are Patrick Leahy and Peter Shumlin. And Shumlin's not going to be on the ballot, and I don't think he's very popular in the state right now anyway, so I don't think it makes a difference there. In Leahy's case, he was out of step with the voters here, but I think the voters in Vermont give him a pass on this. And his explanation when he was asked about it by reporters a couple weeks ago was, I pledged Hillary Clinton my support when she first announced her candidacy before Bernie Sanders became a candidate. And Leahy went on to say, when I make a commitment to a colleague in the Senate, I keep my word, and that's the way I operate. I think voters, considering his 40-plus years of service, are willing to give him a pass on that. So I don't think any of these Democratic politicians would necessarily be hurt by their support for Hillary Clinton in the primary. What I am interested to see for the general election in Vermont is, if Hillary Clinton does end up as the nominee, how active is Bernie Sanders going to be campaigning for her in Vermont in the fall and in other states as well, where he did well? And what is that impact of that on the turnout in the general election in the fall? And that can make a big impact on the results in the governor's race, because I think the higher the turnout, the more likely it is, the more difficult it becomes for the Republican gubernatorial nominee, because he will need a lot of ticket splitting. Now, that can be done. Jim Douglas demonstrated it can be done. But I think how enthusiastic Vermont Democrats are in the fall for Hillary Clinton could have an indirect effect on the outcome of the governor's race.
You know, that was going to be my last question to you, is voter turnout for Democrats in the presidential race. Do Sanders people sit on their hands and stay home?
It's possible, and I think it has to do. I think the answer to that question, Mike, is going to be based on, A, how Hillary Clinton treats Bernie Sanders in the remaining months of the campaign, what kind of role he has at the convention if she's the nominee, is he given a primetime speaking slot, are some of his views incorporated into the platform, will she give him a shout out in her acceptance speech and so forth, and then how active he decides to be in campaigning for Hillary Clinton in Vermont and other northeastern and west coast states where Sanders is strong, generating Democratic turnout, not just for Hillary Clinton, but in some of these states for Democrats running for the Senate or governor. For example, Maggie Hassan, who's the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in New Hampshire.
We've been speaking with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Thank you very much, Eric, for your time.
My pleasure, Mike.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We are getting right into presidential politics today and yesterday's Super Tuesday results. We just spoke with Eric Davis, a professor emeritus at political science at Middlebury College. And now up right here in our WDEV studios is Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
So let's sort of start off where we started off with Eric, but flip the parties. What's your take on the Republicans last night?
Well, it is clear to me that that Donald Trump is probably on a path that perhaps he can't be stopped. I was amazed, Mike, when about 6 weeks ago, some of my former, some union line workers at Green Mountain Power, who've been Democrats, told me they were going to vote for Donald Trump. That told me that the Vermont Trump support was going to be much stronger than I would have ever imagined. And then the Castleton University poll, and then we saw the results last night. So I'm not sure there is enough support still for either Cruz or Rubio to stop Trump.
Do you think the Republicans made a mistake and didn't take him on sooner? Donald Trump, we're talking about.
Yes, and they also believed, as frankly a lot of us did here in Vermont, that this his candidacy is a joke. It won't last. And then after he did some of his more outrageous comments, we were all waiting for the end of Donald Trump. But lo and behold, he seemed to get stronger.
One of the things that he said yesterday, last night, as he was talking in his press conference, it was more like some of the points that he made at Burlington when he was up here. But one of the things that he talked about was that he is expanding turnout in the Republican Party. And if you look at the numbers, right, he's probably right.
Well, it is. There is no question about that. As we look at the results across the country so far, there has been a strong Republican vote, and the Democratic vote is not even as strong as it was in 2012. So I think that is going back to my little focus group of the GMP unionized linemen, that Trump is attracting people that have either been independents, even some Democrats, then they are crossing over, much to my surprise in this state.
Who do you think is going to be taking up the mantle to be the main competitor, the main challenger to Trump? Because he has benefited from the fact that there were so many Republicans in the field, gave him time to sort of consolidate a base while others were splitting it up.
Well, I think for me, the answer will come after the Florida vote. And that is Rubio able to win his home state? And if that does not happen, I don't see any other alternative than perhaps if Ted Cruz can convince members of his party that Donald Trump is simply not a real Republican.
And the polls show that Trump is up fairly substantially in Florida, and he's ahead of Kasich in Ohio, which is interesting to me because, as Eric Davis said, Kasich is a very popular governor out there, and Trump is ahead of him right now.
Right, and as we know, Mike, elections close and get tighter as you get near election day. So I think I would agree with Eric that that Kasich still has a chance in his home state. But if he can't make it work there, I mean, he's already announced that that's it for him.
Bernie and Trump seem to have hit on a nerve with the American public that they are fed up with the way that politics are run, the way that Washington is run, the way that the economy is run, the way that the election process is run. They come at it in whole different ways. But have they hit a nerve here that seems to be that many missed?
No question at all. I mean, I think those of us in Vermont were early on focused on Bernie's message, and we understand where that is coming from. But I think as the populism of the Trump message started to be heard, it not only scared the Republican establishment, but it was connecting in a way that was surprising to all of us.
We're speaking with Steve Terry, who's the WCAX political analyst, and we're talking about Super Tuesday results. If you want to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Dick in St. Albans. Dick, you're on open mic.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I went and voted yesterday, and when they asked me which ballot I wanted, Republican or Democrat, I said neither. They said, you got to take one. I said, well, give it to me. So they passed over the ballot. I went and did my voting thing, and I took that ballot that they gave me to the machine and put it in the machine. It wouldn't go through. And I tried it two or three times, and I said, well, I'm not voting for any of these blurps. I threw it on top of the machine. Well, one of the people watching the machine came over and pushed a little button in the front, and the ballot went through. You know, the machine accepted the ballot. But on that ballot, there was nothing on it. So my opinion of this is a dog and pony show. This is a massive deception on the American people, what's going on right now. And they better pay very close attention to where this is going, because I don't think this is going to have a good ending result.
Thanks, Dick. Thank you for the call. Dick was being a rascal yesterday at the polls, it looks like. But it is an unusual election. I don't think we had any sort of thought. If you would have asked me 6 months ago how this election was going to go, it would have been quite a bit different than the way it's turning out, I think.
Sure. I think you're absolutely right. But, you know, that is the everlasting mystery of politics. When real voters get a chance to have their say, we can be surprised if we just listen to people like us. I mean, things change, and this election has been a humbling experience for us all.
So what you're saying is don't listen to us.
Well, I'm saying we're not always right.
Let's go to Anita in Middlesex. Anita, don't listen to us. We don't know what we're talking about. How are you?
I'm fine. Good morning. A couple questions or a couple comments. why is the national press being so dismissive of Bernie and his campaign? It's almost like Hillary already has won. And I'm a woman. I'd like to see a woman in there. However, what's wrong with a Clinton-Bernie choice? That would be my choice. And the other thing is, I would think the local leaders and the Times Argus might have a little egg on their face supporting Clinton so strongly. My thought is that they should have supported our Bernie, even though he may have to moderate and listen to the people. So I'd just like to make that comment and find out from you folks, why is the national press so dismissive? It's almost like Hillary has won. That's my question. Thank you.
Steve.
Number one, I think the national media as a whole, not all of them, were absolutely convinced, much like, frankly, Donald Trump early on, that Bernie's campaign would not sustain itself. When he started to really connect and raise incredible amount of money fast, I think the view on him changed. And there is, and I think there has been, at least in the last month or so, as the Clinton controversies once again continue to be a bit of a cloud over her campaign, there was a moment, certainly after New Hampshire, where I saw, just watching the national media, they seemed to have some new respect for Bernie.
Let's go to Mary in Richmond. Mary, you're on open mic.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm a volunteer, and I counted ballots in Richmond until 11 o'clock last night. And the gentleman who was just ahead said something about his ballot wouldn't go through, and then they pushed a button, it went through. Well, there is a mechanism to enter a ballot that has no check on it. So it counts as a zero ballot. And if you take a look at the, you know, nobody gets to see these. I mean, you certainly can. But they go to the election headquarters after the ballots are counted. The slip that comes out of the machine says these ballots were recorded with no vote. So it counts as a zero vote. It doesn't count for a Democrat or a Republican. It counts as a zero vote. But I think one of the most important things about any election is you should really think about voting for the smartest person. And by far, I believe it's Ben Carson. And if you just look at brains alone, that man's got it in diamonds. Thank you very much.
What do you think? After all, he's a brain surgeon.
Well, he is a brain surgeon, but I'm not sure that elective politics is his new profession.
Why do you think he's still staying in?
Well, I think there is a strong view among people who put their names on ballots that they really have something to say. And I can only imagine that he is still feeling the warmth from his passionate supporters. And once you enter a race and you've got a lot of people behind you, or it seems, it's hard for you to withdraw. And that's a discussion we should have about Bernie a little bit later.
When I look at Bernie's vote, and let's switch to there. You gave me a great segue to switch. But if you look at Bernie's votes, his votes are coming from white, sort of middle class, progressive. If you look at Hillary Clinton, she has a huge, huge advantage in the minority community, African-Americans, Hispanics. Across the board, she has a huge advantage. What does Bernie have to do?
I don't. Well, first of all, he has to win somewhere. And, you know, maybe the Midwest, the union voters offer him a chance. But overall, I think Bernie will be in this race until the convention. He will not stop. He is running a movement as much as he's running a campaign.
Let's go back to the phone line. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. A couple points I want to make. First off, I'm Bernie. The one thing that I think he has failed to do is take his economic message and show how important the economics and the loss of political control due to huge money coming into the system really affects everything, including the race issues, not just the jobs issues. And he's made some tries at it, but he has not done that very well. And that's where I think his major failing has been and why he hasn't really crossed that divide, for, you know, to be able to pick up more of the minority vote, my opinion. The other thing is, on Trump and Bernie being a surprise as far as how well they've done, you know, both of them, and you know, I do not like Donald Trump at all, but both of them picked up on issues that were very mainstream in their particular parties. And Trump picked up on the borders and the immigration issue. And while he likes to claim credit for bringing that to the forefront, that had been a big issue, especially with the Tea Party side of the Republican Party, but it had also been a big issue in the Republican Party for well over a decade by this point. And Sanders is, you know, he went out there and he talked to an issue that's been growing, and we saw that get some mainstream coverage with the Occupy Wall Street bit, but it certainly has come on strong, this bit about the economics and the fairness of this divided economy that we live under. So with that, those issues combined with the fact that communications are not the same that they were 10 years ago, and headlines now travel via Twitter. They don't travel via CNN or Fox News or the New York Times or even the Burlington Free Press. So the combination of both candidates really had what are really mainstream issues to people, and the fact that the communications is very different, that's why both of them are doing as well as they are.
Thank you for the phone call, Rama. Rama brings up this point. Bernie's message of the system is rigged, and to some extent what we talked about earlier, Trump has that right. Sort of thing, that it's being held by elites. And so what Rama is saying is that he hasn't been able to get that message to the minority community out there, and he's wondering why.
Well, I think that's still in my own view, I think there is more evidence that that the younger members of the minority voting bloc are beginning to resonate with that. Rama is right. It hasn't been strong enough yet. But I believe that the reason that Bernie and I suppose Trump have really moved so fast is they are connecting with some deep passions, frustrations of voters. And I believe that eventually that Bernie may do better in the non-Southern states with the African-American voters.
Let's go to Steve and Barry. Steve, you're on open mic.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Regarding the gentleman who called about being told he had to take a ballot, that's just plain wrong. As I understand it, whether you cast a primary ballot or not, once you take it, that's noted, and you are only able to caucus with that party if you're interested in any party matters. So if he took a Democratic ballot and he now wants to caucus with his town Republicans or town progressives, in theory, although I doubt anybody would check, he is barred from doing so.
Steve, I don't think Steve, can I just interrupt you for a minute? Because
sure.
I know a little bit about this, and the fact is we do not have a primary system where you're talking about a primary system where you're registering.
We don't have party registration.
We have an open registration. So when you take a ballot yesterday, you take either a Republican. It's the only time that you're asked this. When you take a ballot, you either got to take a Democratic ballot or a Republican ballot, and it's marked down whether you take an R or a D on the voter checklist. But that's it.
And then that information can be made available as a public document to the parties, and it just helps them identify a potential voter. It does not mean anything else.
And if you go to the primary in August or into the general election, you can do whatever you want.
That's correct.
And you don't have to caucus with anybody. Steve, is that the way that you understand it?
Well, I think we can check with William Senning at the Secretary of State, because that's not my understanding, but yeah. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I had Secretary of State Jim Condos on yesterday, and he explained it exactly how I just talked about it. So I think I'm right. Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic.
Well, hi, Mike. I think it's a question of leadership, but of course leadership is difficult because it's in the eyes of the beholder. But when I was in the Army, and you probably could testify to it too, when I was in the Army, when I saw leadership, I knew what it was. And I don't see leadership with Hillary Clinton.
Do you see it with Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders?
I don't see it with Bernie Sanders either. But Donald Trump seems to have some sort of, I don't know what it is, you know. And I think that he has more leadership qualities than the other two candidates. That's my opinion. But like I say, it's in the eyes of the beholder, you know.
What do you think, Steve?
Well, you know, I know that Donald Trump talks a lot about what the problem is. I must say, unless I've missed it, I never hear him describe how to fix the problem. And I think if he indeed is the nominee for the Republican Party, as it looks, he will be really pressed hard in the months ahead on that issue. And his charm or his attraction may start to fade, although I'm not betting on that.
But one of the things, and I wrote about this maybe 6-7 weeks ago, that something's going on here. Something in this state is going on, and particularly when you look at the results yesterday, I was very surprised by the turnout in the Republican Party. It was much more than what I expected. Mm-hmm. Now there's a lot of contested races there, and you know, in terms of the number of candidates in that primary, but I was surprised by the turnout there. So there's something going on, and there's something attracting Vermonters to Donald Trump, and it may be what the caller had said, leadership.
Well, it's perhaps, but I think it's still, at least the people I know who have normally would vote the other way, went into that primary. They love his bluster. They love his taking on the establishment.
One of the things that... what I'll do, Tom, is take this call. Ken, I'm going to ask you to be very, very quick. Tom is indicating to me I got to take a break, and we'll go from there. Ken from South Burlington, you're on.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I just would make the point, I've been an independent all my life, and I'm really not comfortable with having to, even in a primary, pick one or the other. I don't see why, even in the primary, we can't get both ballots, mark one, and have the other shredded. Or something to that nature. And in Massachusetts, for example, the ballot you take, you're automatically in that party unless you undeclare that party within 30 days. So I'd like us to look at that a little bit. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Ken. Tom, we're going to go right up to the top of the hour on this. Doesn't like the primary.
Well, then I think you need to go back to the legislature, because that was a compromise that was worked out 6 or 8 years ago.
And the compromise was the closed primary sort of party registration. Vermont didn't want that.
No.
But the parties, the Washington parties, wanted some way to identify voters in a presidential primary. And this is the only time you have to do this.
That's correct.
Is in a presidential primary. Steve, I've got a ton of questions. I want to get to them. Can I ask you if you could stay?
Sure. I'd be glad to.
What we'll do is 10:15 to 10:30 and
sure.
Go from there.
Be glad
but
to.
Let me ask you this. Where Bernie Sanders, I'm always curious about this with media and how they report it. If Bernie Sanders, if the victories in Vermont, Minnesota, Colorado, and Oklahoma had come earlier than they did. And Vermont came very early, but Minnesota, Colorado, and Oklahoma came around 10 o'clock. The other two came later. Would that have changed the narrative for the night, even though Clinton got seven primary states?
I think it would have. As we know, Mike, momentum is such an important part of how the media and how people feel about a campaign. So it may have, but at the moment, it seems to me like, for instance, the vote in Massachusetts was what really convinced me that push comes to shove, the establishment machine, Democratic politicians, Boston, Worcester, produced for Hillary. And I suspect they are working those alliances that she's had for years, the Clinton family. So it's going to be hard for Bernie to win the nomination.
Let's go to Fred in Moncton Ridge. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. Mike, you seem real happy about the turnout from the Republican side this morning. Who are you supporting? And you sound real happy about this. Are you going to be a Trump supporter? This is your party. This is Jim Douglas's party. Ronnie Reagan, William F. Buckley. You're in that standing group. Are you going to be putting your positioning and all your power as a Republican behind the presumptive nominee? And I'll get off the phone.
Thanks, Fred. You know, I love these calls because when I am just a little bit critical of a Democrat, I get all the calls that I'm some sort of partisan. And when I'm bash Republicans, I don't get any calls. So, you know, the fact is, I've been very, very critical of Donald Trump, Fred. Matter of fact, you know, if you go back, I think I've written four columns about Donald Trump in the newspaper. So, you know, give me a break.
I would just remind us, for history's sake, that Jim Douglas was very cool and did not support Governor Romney. It's at least my memory. And that he stayed out of that, that 2012 campaign.
Absolutely. And, you know, Fred, just go back and read my columns. You can see I've been pretty harsh to my detriment. A lot of people have called me about the fact that I've been so harsh on Donald Trump. So one quick question. We got about 30 seconds here, Steve. Just want to sort of look at this. Where does Bernie go from here?
He keeps going, and he will go and he will go all the way to the convention in Philadelphia. What his role will be, it remains to be seen.
Coming up, we'll check in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then we'll bring Steve back because I didn't get all the questions that I wanted to get in. We'll bring Steve back, and then we're going to get off presidential politics for a little while. We're going to talk to Josh Kelly, who's the Material Management Section Chief for Waste Management and Prevention at ANR, at the Agency of Natural Resources. And we're going to talk about recycling and waste management. And that, it's about the Vermont Universal Recycling Law. What does that mean to you? What does it mean to residents and businesses and municipalities and schools? This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island and Pontacourse. We're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Tom, I'm going to jump right on the bumper because we got a lot to get to today. On the line is Bob Ney, our colleague down in D.C. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. Good song for the long way to Philadelphia and Cleveland conventions.
I love Supertramp. Yes. Let's talk Democrats first. Mm-hmm. What did you see? What's your takeaway from yesterday?
The winner needs 2,383 delegates, because we got to go to that type of thing. Hillary Clinton has 1,085. Bernie Sanders has 418. Bernie took four states. Now, having said all of that, Bernie will argue, well, nationally he does better, for example, against Trump than Hillary does. He has less baggage, etc. If Bernie Sanders doesn't take another single delegate, Bernie Sanders will not drop out of this race, period. Now, he's going to continue to win, so he won't drop out. I know they want him to, but he's not. Because he's causal, he has a cause, he has millions of people, he has $42 million, and he's probably going to raise $4 million today in $27 contributions. So he has an issue and a cause. So I tell my friends, kind of get used to Bernie Sanders not letting Hillary go to the middle. He's going to keep her to the left.
If you look at the numbers, Bob, both with Hillary Clinton and you look beyond and sort of look at the breakdown, Bernie Sanders has a problem with minorities. If you look in the South, she's taken minority vote 68% to his, 30% or
right.
And so how's he overcome that? He doesn't get the nomination without the minority vote, does he?
No, he doesn't. But let me play Marco Rubio for a second here. If everybody drops out, Marco Rubio can win the nomination. Well, with Sanders, if he was the nominee, would the African-American community go to Donald Trump? No. They would go to Bernie Sanders. So, this is the thinking. So, but you still got to get through the primary. So it doesn't matter what African-Americans would do in the general. You have to get through the primary. And African-Americans will tend to be with the Clintons. Not because of some position Bernie took. I don't buy that. I know Bernie Sanders. He's not. He's good on race. But because of the fact that Clintons have been around a long time, Bill Clinton, et cetera. And, yes, that's a problem Bernie has when you look at the South and large city.
I'm just curious. You're in the media. I'm in the media. If the results have come out earlier for Bernie Sanders, of course he won Vermont, and that was announced early. But if Minnesota, Colorado, Oklahoma would have come out earlier, would that have changed the narrative last night? The narrative is Hillary Clinton won big.
Well, Bernie was smart to have his speech done right away. It gave him a at least he's there. But I agree. You know how the media is. If those other states had come in first, it'd be like, ooh, Hillary Clinton, even though we know, Hillary Clinton's kind of in a nail-biter here, But the fact remains that Bernie Sanders does have 418 delegates, almost half of what Hillary Clinton has. And let's face it, Hillary Clinton's kind of got the system rigged because the party's got this super-delegate thing, and even though Bernie beat her, she got more delegates. You know how that scenario runs. Mm-hmm. So when you kind of look at the numbers, not bad, Bernie. I mean, Clintons have been at this all their life to become president. For Hillary, and it's not bad. I mean, and there's time yet. And if Hillary Clinton makes a major stumble, Katie bar the door, this thing can become like the Republican side. This thing's going to go in open to the convention. But I still argue Sanders stays in no matter what. I told a Democrat friend of mine today, get used to it. He's not dropping out.
Trump on his way to the nomination?
He's on his way, but he's probably not going to have enough delegates. Here's the bottom line of what happened last night. The biggest loser was Rubio. I mean, it was, not to coin the phrase, but it was huge. He lost. And I'll tell you why. Because he's going into Florida right now with Trump at 39% of the vote and Rubio 18% of the vote in his home state. Are you going to lose your home state, beat your fist down at night, and say, now it's on to another state? No. So I argue that if in the next 7 days, even before March 15th, Florida vote, if Rubio looks like he cannot win Florida, he has to jump out of the race. Whereas our governor, I'm from Ohio, John Kasich, if he simply wins Ohio and no other state, he's in the race into the convention with Cruz.
You think Cruz is the person that's going to take up the mantle of being the challenger to Trump?
No. See, the establishment, Karl Rove, I thought they were going to have to put paddles on him on Fox last night to bring him back from a heart attack. They have nowhere to go. Rubio, they all went to Rubio. And that's what's going to keep Rubio in this for a little bit, unless he tanks in Florida, money. And they're creating a pact today with former Governor Whitman of New Jersey, Republican. And it's a get Donald Trump pact. It's called Principle. They're all going after Trump. Now, the problem they have is they dislike Cruz more than they dislike Trump, the establishment. So I think if Rubio drops out, Kasich's their guy. That's what I think.
Do you think it's too late to stop Trump? The Republicans, as you said, they're putting together this pack. They're panicking, even conservatives, because conservatives don't view Trump as a conservative. So do you think it's too late?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. It's now, again, I don't think he's going to go in the convention with the magic number that he needs, which is 1,237. I don't think he's going to go in with that. But I think he's going to go in leading, but it is absolutely too late to throw him out of this race. It's too late. I'm not saying he's got it locked up. He has to fight at the convention. It is far too late. And the more they come out with, like, this pack today, let me predict to you. Take Senator Portman of Ohio. He's in a tight race. He's a Republican senator. The Trump people in Ohio pretty soon are going to start going to people like Portman's office and picketing with signs. You know, what's the party trying to do? Are you dictators? Guys like Portman will run back to Mitch McConnell, their Republican leader, and say, can you please be quiet? Mm-hmm. You know, there's some dynamics here. The senators that are up for election, and, you know, you got Kelly Ayotte in
New Hampshire,
New England, neck of the woods there. You know, they could be in some trouble if the Trump supporters start to lean on them and say, we're going to take it out on you if you don't stop this party dictatorship stuff. You go to your bosses and tell them to stop it. I mean, that thing happens in politics. It makes them nervous, especially the senators.
Trump has claimed that he has expanded the Republican Party. And if you look at the numbers, if you look at who's participating in these primaries, the Republicans have had bigger participation in their primaries. Is he right? He's expanding the turnout here?
I think he's expanding it with controversy. I mean, my friends that I've had a long time are so angry at me. They're like, no, these... And I say, look, these are not... I'm from Appalachia, Ohio, okay? So I can tell you this. These are all not, quote, redneck people that are voting for Donald Trump. A friend of mine said, these are all rednecks. No, there's a wide variety of people. There's all kinds of people. This is not just everybody that... You know, a stereotype going to a NASCAR event. I mean, really. So Trump has expanded the tent. 20,000 people in Massachusetts voted Republican. I don't think they just did that to go get Donald Trump. I think he created that. Now, having said that, though, he's so controversial where even people that support him say, ooh, no, I don't like David Duke. Why did he do that? You know, there's problems. Yes, he's expanded the tent, but he's also set one of the walls on fire of the tent.
What do you foresee for the Republican Party? Are they headed for a breakup here?
I think if the leaders of the Republican Party, the Mitch McConnells of the world, I keep picking on him, the Karl Rove, you know, the guys that have been around, Gingrich, if they don't get a hold of themselves and let the will of the people speak, they need to just stop it. The party is readjusting itself, and hey, the majority of the party will decide. That's what we have voters for. The more they interfere, the more they're going to really hurt the party in the long run. The party's readjusting itself.
You have to give Bernie and Trump some credit in that they recognized early on that there's a huge amount of dissatisfaction out there. And although they come from different ways at it,
that's
Bernie
right.
saying it's rigged for billionaires, Donald Trump saying it's rigged for the D.C. elites and the business elites, you got to give them credit that they recognized this early on, that there was a huge dissatisfaction out there.
I'm going to toot my own horn. If you go back to podcasts, the day Trump announced, I said he wasn't a flash in the pan. And when Bernie announced, they wouldn't even say his name on CNN, I said at that time, you watch what happens with Bernie Sanders. And I said he and Trump are alike in different ways. I knew it that day. Those crowds were brewing. People wanted to go somewhere. People were angry. I knew that day, though, neither one of them was a flash in the pan. They have changed the face of modern politics.
As always, Bob, thank you so much for your insight. That's Bob Ney at Talk Media News. We'll be back with Steve Terry in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome Steve Terry, who is continuing with us. He's the WCAX political analyst. He's continuing with us for a few more minutes here because I didn't get to all the questions. We're talking presidential politics and yesterday's Super Tuesday results. And if you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Before I go to a phone call here, Steve, just one sort of question. The New York Times sort of has laid out Hillary Clinton's plan to defeat Donald Trump. And the way that they're thinking is that you need to label him as a bigot and you got to label him as not for the working class. Is that going to work?
Well, you know, I don't think Donald Trump helped himself at all by being so wishy-washy on whether or not he would condemn the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan. I cannot imagine any modern politician not doing that, and that certainly plays into the argument that he's a racist, that some people really strongly believe. Now, and I think that I've been hearing recently that there's a lot of, I guess we'd call it opposition research that'll be released or dumped on the media on the very issue that Trump seems to champion, that he's such a great businessman. So we will see whether they can take him down with that kind of argument.
Let's go to Bill in Johnson. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Wow, up in the queue so quickly, almost not ready. So I would point out that when the first whiff of those calls that were made on behalf of David Duke happened, the New York Times ran a small piece and stated that the campaign of Donald Trump, who I despise, also did decry it and whatever the word is, repudiate. So he got caught in a bad, he fumbled the question on that show. I want to point out the faults that this election season shows in the two-party system. And we spend a lot of taxpayer money supporting that. So, first of all, why do we have a two-party system? It's self-perpetuating. And wouldn't it be a fantasy if Donald Trump lost the nomination, Bernie Sanders lost the nomination, and both of them ran as independents, and we had four candidates for president for a change? But having said all that, fantasy, why don't we ask the auditors of the state of Vermont and whoever would be that person, the Congressional Budget Office or someone at the federal level, to audit how much public taxpayer funds are spent either indirectly or directly supporting the two-party system, and then send them a bill?
Thanks, Bill. What do you think?
Well, I guess, what do you mean by supporting the two-party system? I mean, if a candidate X urges a new road in your part of the state, is that a campaign contribution? So I guess I'm not sure how that could be demonstrated.
But Bill brings up a good point, and the point is, are we destined... This is something we've never seen before. Massive dissatisfaction in the Republican Party if Donald Trump becomes the nominee. Maybe dissatisfaction in the Democratic side if Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee. Are we destined at some point to have a viable third party?
Well, yes. I think eventually we will. And I think it is important to note that Bernie, I suppose he could change his mind, but you know, months ago said he would not be the Ralph Nader of 2016. But
Donald Trump said the same thing. But.
Yes, eventually, there is no question. I mean, we have a senator from Maine. We've had governors from Maine. Yes, I think that is a natural evolution.
Let's go to Forbes. Forbes, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
First of all, a disclaimer. I'm bringing things back local. I don't aspire to Bernie Sanders' philosophy, basically. But it just seems inconceivable. I mean, he's done a lot more for Vermont than I have. But it seems inconceivable with our small impact here in Vermont on the national level that both Shumlin and Leahy endorsed Clinton. I mean, that to me is just unbelievable, looking into the impact level that Vermont would have on the whole scene, why they wouldn't have supported somebody who has done a lot of good for Vermont also. I can't see it.
That's an excellent question, and will it come back to it? Certainly, Governor Shumlin isn't running for re-election, so it's probably not going to come back to haunt him, and it actually may help him if Hillary Clinton is the eventual president. But does it hurt Patrick Leahy?
You know, I have seen no evidence yet that it has. And, you know, we are pretty tolerant people in Vermont. And I think that Patrick Leahy will be reelected without any difficulty. I will say, I was surprised at the end of the day when Governor Shumlin endorsed Hillary Clinton. Because perhaps a year earlier, I think anybody having a discussion with him would have thought that he would be supporting Bernie, because he was quite grateful for the help that Bernie gave him in his own, which turned out to be, a very tough reelection.
I'm noticing there's no loyalty in politics, but the broader issue that I want to bring up, does it mean in Vermont at least that those, look, Bernie Sanders supporters don't necessarily like Hillary Clinton, so do they stay home during the election?
Well, I think it's a presidential year. I think Senator Leahy will be spending a lot of money, even though he's not contested, getting out the vote. I still think that we will see Vermont in the Democratic column after the November election.
In, but for which race?
For president.
Okay.
Now, the rest of the races at this point are a real jump ball, in my judgment.
Let's go to Peter in Waitsfield. Peter, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Bill. I look at the two races for nomination as two boxing matches that are rigged. And in the end, some of the people witnessing the contest are going to go home very disappointed. Bernie's got a silver tongue, and Hillary is very vulnerable on policy. And Bernie's, for example, Bernie's talked about courting the black vote, the astounding number of black and brown men and women locked up in the criminal justice system, and the odds of that a black man has a 1 in 4 odds of going to prison or jail. And yet he's failed to mention that it was Clinton, not that it was Hillary, but it was Clinton policy that threw 3 strikes and you're out, mandatory minimum sentencing, et cetera, that led to this over-incarceration of black and brown people. And Bernie hasn't done that, which makes me question that whether or not Bernie isn't really, you know, working in a way for Clinton. But have you heard about the Trump-Clinton conspiracy?
I have heard about it. I don't buy it, Peter. You know, the Trump-Clinton conspiracy is Trump gets into the race in order to make sure that Hillary Clinton wins the race. And he tries to be as outrageous as possible so that she wins easily. You know, you certainly can make, Steve, you can certainly make the case for the fact that if you wanted a conspiracy sort of theory, you could make that it's rigged for the Democrats. But I can't believe you can make that same theory for the Republicans, because the Republicans don't want this sort of outcome.
No, they? And they're moving very quickly towards a convention that'll be a real chaos in Cleveland.
And that's going to be really interesting as this moves forward. Rubio is planning for a brokered convention, which is not a very good winner sort of scenario to look at. You know, certainly between the two of them, as Bob Ney had talked about, they're hoping that they can get enough delegates to not have Donald Trump win the nomination, and then hope they can persuade people at the nomination. That will produce chaos, I would think.
Right, and although there hasn't been, as Eric pointed out, a first ballot denial for a long time, I did cover, as a journalist, a 1976 Republican convention, and in which Ronald Reagan ran a strong floor campaign against then Gerald Ford. As we know, Ford won that convention, but lost to Jimmy Carter
and
as
mostly,
a result.
Yeah, and mostly because the conservatives sat home.
That's correct.
And it was to the detriment, who was an incumbent at the time, Gerald Ford,
right,
to his presidency. The last question I have is, I was sort of sitting back noticing last night that both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump referred to their candidacy not as a candidacy but as a movement. Is that something that is that how they view the world?
Well, I'm not sure about Donald Trump. It's the first time I've heard him say that. But I will say this has all on the Bernie Sanders side. This is how he has done politics. Just as a quick historical note, yesterday I looked at again Bernie's press conference after he lost the 1986 governor's race, in which he talked about how he would run again, and he laid out how the movement would work to change policies. And it seems to me he is still in that mode.
Steve Terry, thank you very much for joining us today. Steve Terry, WCAX analyst, I thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're going to change the subject here. We're going to move away and take a breather from presidential politics and switch to the topic of Vermont's new universal recycling law. What does it mean for you? What does it mean for residents, businesses, schools, and municipalities, and haulers? Joining us in our WDEV studios is Josh Kelly, who's the Material Management Section Chief for the Department of Environmental Conservation, which is at the Agency of Natural Resources, to answer some of our questions. Good morning, Josh.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
What is the goal of the universal recycling law?
The real goal is to increase recycling and also composting and sort of the beneficial use of organic waste throughout the state. And we've had a recycling rate that has been stagnant at about 30 to 35% for about a decade or more, actually more than a decade. And the legislature in 2012 was looking at this and unanimously passed this legislation, sort of calling for an increase in recycling. They'd sort of seen that recycling had taken hold pretty well across the state, but that it still could use a boost. Not everybody had the same level of services across the state. So its goals were to increase recycling and to do that to ensure that all Vermonters have convenient and consistent recycling services. And then to be taking these steps on our food waste, which makes up a really significant portion of the waste stream. It's as much as almost a third of what's still being thrown away.
So the need for the law was to increase our recycling efforts, it seems.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Let's roll through how this law affects different people.
Sure.
For example, me at home as a resident, how does it affect me?
Yeah. Well, it started with the requirement that the recyclable materials, and those are paper, cardboard, aluminum cans and foil, steel cans, glass containers and jars and bottles, and then plastics, jars and jugs, numbers 1 and 2 are required to be recycled. And that went into effect this summer, July 1, 2015. For many Vermonters, you know, they were doing this anyway. I'd say Vermonters are recyclers by nature. And so that didn't amount to that much change. But in some areas, they didn't have curbside services for those materials. They had to self-haul it themselves in their cars down to the recycling center. So many people have curbside recycling services that haven't in the past. That's the first sort of change for residents. That's all.
And let me ask this, Josh, just so I can clarify from a question that a colleague here at the station had. When you recycle, do you have to have certain boxes for different things that you recycle, or can you just throw it all in one sort of container and put that out at the curbside?
That's a great question. Most of Vermonters have what we call single stream recycling. I think the the program that Casella calls it is zero sort. Myers calls it no sort, which is really that your recyclables, your paper, your cardboard boxes, your cereal box, your plastic milk jug can all go in the same container. That doesn't mean you throw your trash in there with it, which is a misconception in some parts of the state. Trash is not supposed to be in with your recyclables. But those can go in one container, and they go to, generally, they go to one of two MRFs, material recovery facilities in the state, where they literally sort that stuff and bale it for market. There are some places, like in the Northeast Kingdom, where people do still separate, you know, plastic from glass, from metal, from paper, and the Northeast Kingdom district actually bales that themselves. So by people sorting up there, they actually are saving some costs and able to recognize the revenue from those materials.
What about food scraps? What happens with food scraps here?
For residents, there is a requirement that food scraps not be thrown away coming up in 2020. It's a ways away, but it will be here. And in general, Vermonters have been, many folks have been composting for a long time, and it's a pretty simple and cheap and effective way to handle your food scraps and food waste. But there also will be more services available through the Universal Recycling Law. So next year, transfer stations that take trash need to take food scraps from residents. And some of them already do that. There's several drop-offs around the state. And to some extent, with the rollout of the law that we've seen so far, even though there's not a ban on food waste right now for residents, many people have already gone out and bought a composting unit or are already using a drop-off that's in their area. In the Northeast Kingdom, they had doubled the amount of food waste in the past couple of years at their drop-off locations. The Chittenden County area has seen a steady about 10% increase in food drop-off each year. So it's gradually growing as people get aware of what the requirements are.
And if I have a business, are those same requirements required of the business?
Yeah, and actually a little bit earlier. So businesses are on a phased-in timeline. And I include institutions in there as well, because there's colleges and universities in the state and others that produce, you know, larger amounts of food waste. So there's a phased-in timeline, essentially started in the summer of 2014 for 2-ton per week generators. That's quite a lot of food waste. And our initial sort of research and cold calls to some of those businesses and institutions, it really didn't make good business sense to be throwing that stuff away. It's very costly. So in all of our cases of large generators of that size, we found they were already doing the right thing. They were either sending it for animal feed, sending it to a farm that has a digester if it was liquid food waste. This is like more manufacturing, like Ben and Jerry's type wash way water, some of the processing waste from dairy industry, cabbage cheese, things like that. That was already going for anaerobic digestion at our on-farm digesters. But as we get closer to 2020, there are several other phases where it gets down to about the half ton per week and a third ton per week. So,
do they have the same recycling requirements as well as residents?
Yes, correct. Those recyclable materials that I mentioned before, the paper, cardboard, aluminum, steel, glass, and plastic, hard plastics 1 and 2 are required to be recycled now by every business and resident in the state.
Municipalities must pass ordinances to implement a variable pricing system by July. What the heck is that?
Yeah, it's kind of a convoluted term. Many people know it as pay as you throw. It's actually not as common in Vermont for your municipality to be offering you a curbside recycling or trash pickup service. In some of those communities that did have this service or offered a transfer station to their residents, the residents were paying through their property taxes for that service. And there was, when you do that, there's not any incentive to recycle in essence, because you don't see the cost. It's all spread out in the taxes. So a pay-as-you-throw system simply just changes the way you pay for it from a tax-based system to a paper bag system. So people buy, I think in Brattleboro now they're doing stickers or bags. Actually, I think they have emblazoned bags. You buy them at the grocery store. You use those bags. You fill those bags. So you pay up front for that bag. I think each bag is $3 or $4, something like that. So that's the shift that's happened this past summer in many of those communities around Vermont. But again, there's not that many of them.
My community, it's in my property taxes, and I haven't changed anything. I do the recycling, I do the trash, you know, in separate containers and leave it out to the curbside. So what has changed for me?
Some Vermont communities have gone with a hybrid approach where they have a certain level of service on the property taxes, like one container a week of trash you can get to have picked up, or one bag. Or they'll give you, some places are giving out these punch cards. You can bring one bag to the transfer station. Each punch card is basically worth, has 52 punches on it for 52 bags a year. 52 weeks in a year, one bag a week, if you get my gist. So if they produce more than that, then they have to start buying. But the property taxes cover that first base level of service. That's the hybrid approach that many municipalities have used to make this change.
Parallel collection, what does that mean? I see it in the material here, but yeah. I'm not sure I know what it means.
Yeah, in short, that is the requirement that wherever trash is collected, that these other materials, the recyclable materials, food scraps, and we kind of call them organics because leaf and yard debris is going to be required to be banned from disposal as well coming up next year. The requirement is if you collect trash that you offer services for the collection of leaf of recyclables first, then leaf and yard debris, then food scraps, and in parallel that everybody has as easy a chance to recycle something as they have to throw it away. That's the meaning of that.
Let's turn to sort of the collection side, the haulers, the small haulers. What do they have to do in order to be prepared for the implementation of this law?
Great question. So with the haulers offering trash services, as I was mentioning, they have to, as of this past summer, offer recycling collection services statewide. And then in phases offer, coming up next, I think it's next summer, when they'll have to offer leaf and yard collection and then food waste collection in 2017. For your residents on the phone, that means you'll have the option of composting at home, going to your drop-off center with your food waste, or seeing what your hauler might offer you for curbside pickup of the food waste. I think in the more dense areas, like Brattleboro is a fairly dense town, they have organics collection right now. They have food waste collection in their town. And its results have been that their trash pickup weekly is sort of not needed as much. They're looking at maybe shifting to every other week because so much material is now removed from the trash, especially the stuff that was smelly and, you know, needed to be collected on a time frame. So that's some of the change that's taken place out there and some of the things that towns are seeing.
Does this have a financial impact, a significant financial impact on small haulers because now they have to separate, you know, I would suspect at the collection point in their truck, for example, and they have to... the other question I have, who enforces this?
Yeah, great question. And I take the first one first. So the financial impact for small haulers. Most haulers were offering recycling services to start with that material before the law was passed. That isn't the case everywhere. And so some of them are looking at ways that they can offer recycling in an affordable way. I've had a lot of conversations with haulers about doing recycling services every other week with trash, which really changes not much for them or their customer, but it is a cultural change where people were used to having collection weekly, shifting to recycling every other week. So in some cases, we have haulers who are buying more recycling carts or dumpsters for businesses as well as residents. There are some new trucks that are being looked at in some areas. And then when it gets to organics, certainly that is a different material altogether. We have a parallel collection fact sheet that we've put out to haulers that basically gives them an idea of what we expect, what's in the legislation, what the intent of it is, and what's required, which basically says that, you know, they should offer some level of service for things like leaf and yard debris. You know, you and I aren't producing leaf and yard debris right now, I mean, other than a Christmas tree. And for the most part, Vermonters are not throwing a lot of that away. We're pretty savvy with that. We either compost it, we mow it in, or we put it to the edge of the property. And they need to offer the food waste collection service. And I think for most residents, it'll be most affordable to drop it off your transfer station or compost at home. But there are haulers that are actually using this as a business opportunity, especially with the commercial sector, to collect food waste on the commercial scale from your restaurants, your supermarkets. And on that, one of the things we've seen, which has been a bit of a surprise, was the increase in donated food. So you think about it, we have all of us go to the grocery store, we buy food every day, and we're amazed at all the variety that we have at our grocery stores. That comes at a cost. Not all that stuff can stay fresh forever, and we don't buy all of it. And so previously, the grocery stores were throwing some of that away. Not all, though. There have been some very progressive grocery stores that have donated that historically, and that has just seen an uptick of about 30% increase in the amount of donated food as a result. Yeah.
So my second part, how do you enforce this?
Oh, great question. Most of it is required that the agency enforce it. So the requirement that the material...
So are you going to be going through trash?
That's the question I get all the time. Is there banana peel police coming to my town? No, there's not going to be, you know, agency reps out inspecting residents' trash. We focus really on hauler compliance, on facility compliance first. We're looking right now at making sure all haulers are offering recycling. And that's been a lot of our focus, just to make sure people have the opportunity to do the right thing. That's really important to us. That's really important to the law as well, that the service be provided.
We're speaking with Josh Kelly, who is the Materials Management Section Chief of the Waste Management and Prevention Division at ANR. If you wish to join our conversation, if you have any questions about the new recycling law, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. We'll return to Josh in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Josh Kelly, who's the Materials Management Section Chief at Waste Management and Prevention Division. It's of the Waste Management and Prevention Division at ANR, that's the Agency of Natural Resources. Okay, so we're doing all this stuff, Josh. We're collecting all these recyclables. We're collecting food waste. What happens to all this?
Yeah, excellent question. So the materials we separate, I think a lot of us are wondering where it goes, and I get the question a lot, does it really get recycled? You know, and if anybody has the chance to visit one of those material recovery facilities, they call them MRFs. There's one in Williston and one in Rutland. You'll see the people who are involved in literally separating that stuff as it whizzes by on the conveyor belt. You'll see some of the contaminants that are in the mix. For one, you know, coffee cups, paper coffee cups are not recyclable. Neither is styrofoam. Those need to go in the trash. And then you'll see them pick this line of all the valuable things. You'll see the bales of things like milk jugs, plastics that are made into everything from fleece, outerwear, Gore-Tex jackets, to the aluminum cans, which are made back into cans, usually in a month or two time. So the soda you're drinking has usually two-thirds recycled content in it. There's a 90% energy savings by recycling that can, and it's one of the most valuable things in the recycling stream. So there is an actual benefit to recycling. And there are jobs and industries that are dependent on that. In fact, recently a bunch of businesses have banded together to help support recycling across the country. The Closed Loop Fund, sponsored by things like Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, I think is another. They're funding municipal recycling systems to help increase the materials that they can use to make new products, to get the shampoo bottles, to get, you know, the milk jugs out of the waste stream and into new products.
We're speaking with Josh Kelly, Materials Management Section Chief at the Waste Management and Prevention Division of ANR. If you wish to join our conversation, you better hurry up. We're starting to get to the top of the hour, 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines and let's go to Ken in Randolph. Ken, you're on open mic.
All right. Thank you. You were talking about the recycling of the food waste. I already compost whatnot, but you didn't specify cooked or uncooked foods. Now, the cooked foods, to my understanding, can't really be used in composting because there's no value left in them.
Ken, that's an excellent question. So there is a lot of information out there on how to compost, what to compost. And so first off, you can compost cooked or uncooked food. And then secondly, I think a lot of the things that people jump to first is, what do you do with meat and bones and meat scraps? Under the universal recycling law, residents are not required to compost meat and bones. So those could be thrown away. But the other food scraps they produce, this is when they compost at home, the other food scraps are all composted and required to be separated from their trash. Many of the drop-off centers I was mentioning before, transfer stations and composting sites that are certified in the state, everyone across the state takes meat and bones right now. And that's because the reason they can take that is because of the high temperatures their compost piles reach. That's 140 degrees in February. That's all natural bacteria that is creating that heat, and that kills pathogens and things of concern, which is harder to do if you're a home composter.
I'm trying to figure out, as I often do, where the burden is in terms of implementing this law, and also the financial burden. Is it on the small haulers that have to sort of change their rigs, get new equipment, or where? How is this funded? I guess that would be the question. How is this funded?
Yeah, that's a good question. The funding for Act 148, there is no funding source for it. It was passed without a funding source. There is definitely a funding need. The agency has been involved with many stakeholders looking at that need. There's a need from everything, like you're saying, haulers and vehicles to containers to more facilities that can, you know, be composting or as I mentioned, anaerobic digestion. So we've been looking at that, but we also have a lot to be thankful for in Vermont. We have over 10 food scrap composters now, even before the law went into effect. And that's where the majority of the food waste is going to, places like Green Mountain Compost in Williston, places like Vermont Compost Company here in Montpelier and Vermont Natural Ag, the Moodoo products down in the Middlebury area. And then we have a dozen food scrap haulers that were already in existence, again, before the law went into effect. They were making the business case for doing this. And then lastly, Vermont has 17 on-farm digesters. They take food processing residuals right now, many of them, and some of them, like Vermont Tech's digester, has been built specifically to take food waste and make renewable energy out of it. And that's happening more and more. Even Green Mountain Power has a few digesters that they're looking into to take more of that material.
Let's go back to the phone lines, and let's go to Lorraine and Bethel. Lorraine, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a question about the envelopes that come from so-called junk mail that have the little plastic or cellophane or whatever windows in them. For years, I've been recycling, and I always cut that out because I thought I had to be in the trash. Does that, or can I put in the whole envelope in the recycle?
You can put the whole envelope in the recycling, Lorraine. You can put even that plastic window. And you're right that previously there was guidance when the recycling industry first started out that they didn't want those plastic windows, but that's changed now. So, yeah, any junk mail you receive, you know, as long as you take out any of those pretend plastic credit cards they stick in there, you can put those in the recycling.
One of the things that is just so that I want the audience to get the timeline here, if you could sort of repeat some of the requirements, go through the universal recycling law timeline in the few minutes that we have remaining.
Sure, happy to. Last summer, July 1, 2015, there was a requirement that we recycle. That's pretty much what people were doing and are doing, and all transfer stations now offer recycling collection across the state. Coming up next year is when leaf and yard debris, this is July 1, 2016, when leaf and yard debris and clean wood is banned from disposal in landfills. Many people can take those to their transfer station right now, and transfer stations are required to offer collection services for those materials already. And then in 2020, food scraps are banned from landfill disposal. And so for residents, there's options, as I mentioned, sort of home composting or drop-off. And I would encourage folks to contact their solid waste management district or group or town to find out about purchasing compost bins at cost. They have some good offers on them.
30 seconds, Josh. Just one one of the things that I'm just sort of, it's in my head here, is that if I'm a small hauler, this is quite a change for me, and the financial burden may be significant. What do I do if it's too significant?
Good question. I've been around the state talking with a lot of these small haulers, and many of them have tried to, as I mentioned before, innovate their businesses to keep. A lot of them are one truck haulers, so they've tried to offer their customers every other week service as a way to save costs, and to some extent, that's working.
Thanks, Josh. We've been speaking with Josh Kelly, Material Management Section Chief of the Waste Management and Prevention Division of ANR. Thank you very much for joining Open Mic.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
And I want to thank all our guests, including Josh, who I just mentioned today, as well as Eric Davis, the Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, Steve Terry, who's the WCAX Political Analyst. He was in studio with us, and we were talking politics during most of this show today, and of course Josh Kelly, who we just spoke with, dealing with recycling requirements in the state. Tomorrow, Bruce Post, who is going to be talking about Green Mountain Highway, and Megan Friesen, who is back from her time in Greece at the Syrian refugee camps. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont. 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.